Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for May's Emergency Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome our speaker for today, ORZVS and European Specialist in Internal Medicine, Yvonne McGrotty. Thank you, Yvonne. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Emer, and good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much for attending this webinar during your lunch break or whatever else you might have been otherwise doing. Today's topic is one of my favourite topics, and that's diabetic ketoacidosis. I think diabetic ketoacidosis can be very challenging, but it can also be very rewarding when you're dealing with these animals in practice. But hopefully by the end of this webinar, I can give you a few little pointers and tips and tricks that might make life a little bit easier, although nobody could ever say that a diabetic ketoacidotic was easy. Okay, so as with always, we have to start with a little bit of pathophysiology and understand why diabetic ketoacidosis occurs. So generally, what we find is that the diabetic ketoacidosis is a result of a severe insulin deficiency. And as far as dogs are concerned, it's certainly the most common endocrine emergency that we're presented with. And when we do, when we are presented with diabetic ketoacidotic patients, mostly more than 70 to 80% of these animals will have additional disease. So it's not just about diagnosing the DKA, it's also about diagnosing the underlying condition that may have triggered it. But when we have a DKA, we have a severe insulin deficiency and, of course, a hyperglycemia. In addition, we have production of ketones, which is key in the pathophysiology of this disease. And unfortunately, despite very aggressive treatment, these cases still have a mortality rate of 25 to 30%. And this is often due to cerebral edema. And in my experience, unfortunately, sometimes the mortality rate is higher in those cases where we are too aggressive with our insulin therapy. So hopefully by the end of today's webinar, I'll have encouraged you to make sure that we're not contributing to the demise of these patients, because they're very much living life on a knife edge. So as I've mentioned, a little bit of pathophysiology always difficult take in. I think I wish I'd paid more attention at vet school in the pathophysiology lectures, but it's too late now. So we have a marked insulin deficiency plus or minus an excess of glucagon. Now this may be a natural occurrence, so the animal may be an undiagnosed diabetic and therefore has a marked insulin deficiency, or it may be that it's a known diabetic and for reasons that are not necessarily clear, the owner has failed to administer insulin to the dog. It applies to cats as well, but we're dealing mainly with the dog today. As a result of that, we get overproduction of glucose and hyperglycemia and decreased peripheral utilization of glucose. And ketosis itself is a result of starvation, so it's an odd situation where there is plenty of glucose in the body, but it can't be used by the cells as insulin is required to move the glucose into the cell. So there's lots of glucose, but it's in all the wrong places. Following that, we get mobilization of fat and protein stores and increased delivery of free fatty acids to the liver, which then lead to production of ketone bodies. And we only get ketoacidosis when the buffering capacity of those ketone bodies is exceeded. So first of all, we get one of the ketone bodies, acetyl coenzyme A, accumulating in the liver. We get acetyl coenzyme A accumulating in the liver, and it's then converted to a ketone body. But as I've mentioned, really we only get clinical signs once the body's own buffering capacity is exceeded. So the body will try and deal with it for a short period of time, but once it's overwhelmed is when the animal starts to deteriorate markedly. The ketone bodies we can potentially detect, there are three. There's beta-hydroxybutyrate. Unfortunately, this one is not detected by a routine urine dipstick, such as your usual urine dipstick or keto dye sticks, a picture of which I've got shown on the right-hand side here. Also, acetoacetate and acetone. Acetone is the one that we're most likely to detect on keto dye sticks or urine dipsticks. So what that means is that it's possible for an animal to be have ketone bodies, but for them not to be obvious on the urine strip because they may be beta-hydroxybutyrate. So don't exclude a diagnosis of ketoacidosis just on the basis of a negative ketone result on your dipstick. It may well be that it's one of the ketone bodies that's not readily identifiable on the dipstick, such as beta-hydroxybutyrate. So the urine dipsticks, keto dye sticks, tend to detect mainly acetone, but also acetoacetate to some degree. There is a little trick that you can use to try and determine if beta-hydroxybutyrate is present, and that's if you're getting a negative result on your dipstick, but you still strongly believe that ketones are present, you can add a small amount of hydrogen peroxide to your urine sample, and that causes oxidation of the beta-hydroxybutyrate, forcing it through the pathway to a detectable form of either acetoacetate or acetone. So if you strongly believe ketones are present but you aren't able to prove it on urine, adding a drop or so of hydrogen peroxide to the sample and then retesting may be enough to prove your point. But if all else fails, you can in fact measure serum beta-hydroxybutyrate at external laboratories, but clearly that's going to take a minimum of 24 hours to get those results. And these are cases where you need to know what's going on pretty rapidly. But ultimately, measurement of beta-hydroxybutyrate is probably going to be more accurate on serum than looking for urine ketones because of the difficulties in detecting all the ketone bodies on the urine dipsticks. Clinical signs of DKA are pretty much just those of diabetes with added problems of dehydration. So the initial presenting signs typically are those of PUPD, often fairly severe lethargy in DKA patients and depression also. They're often very dehydrated. They may have muscle wasting as a result of the diabetes mellitus itself. Equally so, they may have hepatomegaly. So these are just really signs of the diabetes itself as opposed to DKA. And worst case scenario, they may present to you almost comatose because of the effects of the changes that are happening within the body. So the PUPD occurs due to osmotic diuresis associated with the glycosuria. And you may also have signs of concurrent diseases such as vomiting or jaundice if perhaps the pancreas is involved or anorexia as well. So these are additional things to look out for. Just going back there, sorry, I just wanted to show you. This is a picture of a cat on the right-hand side here, and this has the plantigrade posture that you sometimes see in diabetic cats. It's not a sign of DKA, but it can be an indication of a peripheral neuropathy, which is often associated with diabetes mellitus itself. Diagnosis. As you might imagine, hyperglycemia is going to be the primary sign that you're detecting. And once the hyperglycemia crosses the renal threshold, which we believe to be above 10 to 12 millimoles per liter in most animals, it does vary a little bit, you will then get glycosuria. And that glycosuria then contributes to the osmotic diuresis. To be ketoacidotic, you would always also expect there to be ketones, whether that be in the urine or in the serum. But the key element here is that you can have these three parameters at the top here, hyperglycemia, glycosuria, and ketonuria, and the animal can be quite well. Now, the ketones are a sign that things aren't as they should be, but if the animal is well in itself and presents to you as a relatively routine consultation, this animal is not a ketoacidotic. Ketoacidotic animals are sick animals. So the key here is you have the hyperglycemia, the glycosuria, the ketones, and the animal is usually quite significantly unwell and very, very dehydrated. You could also argue to confirm definitively, you could check a blood gas analysis to look for changes in the anion gap, which we'll touch on very briefly later, but I appreciate there aren't that many practices in the UK currently that routinely use a blood gas analyzer, so it's certainly not essential. So remember, a sick animal with these symptoms is ketoacidotic, a well animal with these symptoms is just ketotic, and a ketotic animal can be dealt with much less aggressively than a ketoacidotic. Initial diagnostics, nothing should take priority above and beyond that of providing intravenous fluids. These animals are very dehydrated. So getting wide-bore intravenous access is an absolute priority. And if their circulation is fairly shut down, you should consider even a jugular line. Do remember the importance of aseptic technique. Diabetics, as a rule, have impaired immune system and poor neutrophil function, so they're much more prone to infections than your other types of patients that you'll routinely be putting catheters in. So try and wear gloves, try and use as strict an aseptic technique as possible to avoid complications. To begin with, we want a minimum database. It varies depending on who you speak to as what a minimum database includes, but for me, generally I would expect it to include packed cell volume and total solids, glucose, obviously, usually urea, creatinine and phosphate, and electrolytes. Those to me are the most important aspects of a minimum database. And a minimum database is an immediate blood analysis. There will be further tests that you'll want to run later on, possibly on the same samples, but the priority is just getting that minimum database, that minimum amount of information so that you can proceed. In addition to that, if you have the opportunity, venous blood gases are lovely, but not essential. And of course, because we're trying to confirm the presence of ketones, we would want to test for either plasma and or urine ketones. So also a priority is obtaining a urine sample. And I appreciate these animals are usually quite dehydrated, so they're not going to be producing urine in the initial couple of hours. But it is very important to try and obtain a urine sample as soon as possible. That may mean doing a cystocentesis sample, even if there's just a small amount of urine, you can get hold of some of it, or even a catheterized sample. The catheter should be placed aseptically. So we want to obtain that urine sample. My preference would be cystocentesis where possible. The reason being that we know that it's often an additional comorbidity, an additional disease that triggers a diabetic to become ketoacidotic. So we're looking for that underlying trigger. And that trigger may be something as simple as a urinary tract infection. So if you obtain that sample by cystocentesis at the start of your investigations, not only can you perform routine urine analysis and check for ketones, but in addition to that, you can send that sample to the laboratory for culture and know that any bacteria you get back are relevant because they've been cultured from a cystocentesis sample. There are always going to be risks of contamination with free catch samples and still possible even with clean catheterized samples. So when you've obtained your urine, check for glucose, obviously, check for ketones, and check specific gravity. Remember that specific gravity will be falsely increased by glucose, so it's not unusual to see specific gravities of 10.30, 10.35, even though the animal is markedly PUPD. That specific gravity is misleading, and it's because of the glucose in it falsely increasing the specific gravity. You'll see that in standard diabetics as well. But very important to retain that sample for culture and sensitivity. As I've mentioned, if you're not getting ketones on your sample, you can add a couple of drops of hydrogen peroxide to the urine sample to convert the beta-hydroxybutyrate to acetoacetate, which may then be detected on the dipsticks. Remember also, going back to the frequency of comorbidities, urinary tract infections are very common in diabetics and diabetic ketoacidotics. And because they have poor neutrophil function, they may not have an active sediment. So it's insufficient to look at the urine analysis and say to yourself, well, there's no evidence of red cells or white cells, therefore the sediment's inactive, therefore this animal is unlikely to have a bacterial urinary tract infection. Because of the problems with neutrophil function, they may not have an active sediment, and you can be mistaken in that respect. So even if the urine is otherwise relatively unexciting, that sample should be collected and sent to a laboratory for culture. So let's think specifically about our blood glucose. When an animal with diabetic ketoacidosis presents, usually the glucose will be greater than 28 millimoles per litre, so pretty high. When we have that level of hyperglycemia, we can automatically assume that the animal is dehydrated, even if clinically it's not hugely apparent, although generally it will be. And the reason being that the renal filtration should in itself be able to keep glucose below that level. So if glomerular filtration rate is decreased, it will be much more likely that the animal will have much more augmented levels of glucose in the bloodstream. So blood glucose levels that are exceptionally high automatically tell you there's been a decreased glomerular filtration rate, and these animals need fluid therapy as an immediate intervention. So it therefore follows that fluid therapy on its own can decrease blood glucose in its own right. We're not going to normalise blood glucose with fluid therapy, but we might bring it down to a slightly lower level. So fluid therapy is absolutely critical. And our aim in these cases is to reduce glucose slowly. The reason being that if we bring the glucose down too quickly, we can end up with cerebral edema. And that's why I mentioned at the start of the lecture that in fact sometimes it's our over attempts at controlling glucose in these cases that actually leads to their demise. We need to do things slowly as far as bringing the glucose down is concerned, otherwise we might actually be contributing to the patient's mortality. And I'll speak more about that a little bit later on. Just an aside about cats, they always have to be a little bit different. I've mentioned that once blood glucose is above the renal threshold of somewhere between 10 to 12 millimoles per litre, we'll have glycosuria. And in dogs, that's generally enough to confirm diabetes mellitus. But as we all know, stress hyperglycemia in cats is a real problem. They can have really quite dramatic levels of hyperglycemia due to stress. So I don't think there's a cutoff value above which you can say, oh, this is definitely diabetes mellitus. I would say in all cats, you need a fructosamine to confirm the presence of diabetes. And just as an aside, going back to the ketone production, hyperglycemia, glycosuria and ketones, you would say, certainly fits with ketoacidosis if the animal's sick. But remember also that ketones can be present with the breakdown of proteins in an animal that's maybe been anorexic for a period of time. So we have to be certain, and therefore fructosamine is very much worthwhile. And thankfully nowadays, we can mostly measure fructosamine in-house, for example, which speeds that process up. But always confirm with cats that fructosamine is elevated, confirming the presence of diabetes mellitus. Osmolality might not be something that you're considering very often, but it is an important consideration, and it's relatively easy to work it out. Now, I have included here both standard international units and traditional units. I have found myself in a scenario where I am now having to use units that I'm unfamiliar with, and I'm feeling sorry for myself at having to constantly calculate these. So I felt if any of you out there were in fact more accustomed to traditional units, then I would perhaps try and make life a little bit easier for you. But for most of us, it's going to be standard international units that we look at. And we can calculate osmolality in dogs and cats using this very simple formula. So it's literally you measure your sodium and your potassium, add them together, multiply that by 2, and then add your glucose. And the glucose has to be in millimoles per litre. That's why there's a different formula altogether for anyone who's using machines with different units. So it's a very simple way of measuring osmolality. And the reference range in dogs is somewhere in the region of 290 to 310 millimoles per kilogram, and in cats 290 to 330 millimoles per kilogram. The higher the glucose, the higher the osmolality. That makes sense because it's contributing a huge portion towards the formula that we've just looked at there. So if a patient is truly hyperosmolar, generally the osmolality will be greater than 330 and greater than 350 in severe cases. And this is important because when the animal is hyperosmolar, they often have CNS signs or neurological signs. And that can be very difficult to control. The hyperosmolality itself may resolve with fluids alone because we are bringing the glucose down just with dilution. But if you bring it down too rapidly, that rapid shift will result in cerebral edema. Glucose doesn't equilibrate across the blood-brain barrier terribly well or terribly quickly. So if you do this too quickly, there will be an imbalance. And as a result of that, you will actually cause neurological signs. So even if the animal is presenting as being hyperosmolar, we still have to bring the glucose down very slowly to prevent further deterioration. If we do it too quickly, we can get fluid moving into the brain and cerebral edema, and clearly that could be a disaster. So I'm not sure how many of you will have a blood gas analyzer. As I've mentioned, they're nice to have. They're not essential. I think they're more commonplace these days, but I also think that even if you have one, you perhaps don't fully understand the results it's giving you. So there's just a couple of points I want to highlight here. This lecture isn't enough to cover blood gas analysis. That's an entire webinar in its own right. But what we're looking for is the pH of the blood sample. And this is just on venous blood. Some people believe that blood gas analysis is for arterial samples. And although that's the case, if you're trying to determine oxygenation, actually I do most of my blood gas analysis on venous samples, so very fresh venous samples. So we're looking at the pH of the blood first of all, and we expect the animal to be acidemic, which means the pH will be below 7.35, and we can confirm by checking things like bicarbonate that this is a metabolic acidosis. But don't focus too much on that just now. All you need to look at is the pH, and it's almost certain that the animal is going to be acidemic with a low pH. Lactic acidosis in itself contributes, and that's due to dehydration, and also the keto acids too contribute to this in producing what we call this anion gap. And I think I've got a further slide that dictates a little bit more clearly, or describes rather a little bit more clearly what the anion gap is. A lot of people struggle to get their head around that. But just remember that normal is generally in the region of 12 to 25, so anything above 25 is considered to be increased. So here we are, a slide dedicated to the anion gap. So what is the anion gap? Well, physiologically, a gap is impossible. So it's not actually a real thing, so to speak. But what we're effectively describing is unmeasured anions. So we're measuring sodium and potassium and then taking away bicarbonate and chloride. So that would end up having a negative balance, which isn't possible. So the gap there, so to speak, is usually comprised of things we're not measuring directly on the blood gas analyzer, such as albumin, inorganic phosphates and sulfates. Remember also that if you've got profound hypoalbuminemia, that may actually affect your anion gap. It might decrease it, so just bear that in mind. But don't dwell on this too much. I know it's complicated, but it is something that's worth just knowing a little bit about. But ultimately, if you at least know what the anion gap implies, then there are really only a handful of conditions that will lead to high anion gap, and that's why this can be helpful. So anion gap of greater than 25 will be either due to lactic acidosis, and that's quite likely to be present in DKAs because of dehydration, but obviously there will be other patients that can have lactic acidosis without being ketoacidotic. Ketoacidosis itself, the presence of keto acids contributes to the high anion gap, but also other things such as ethylene glycol and renal failure. So just as a complete aside, if you've got a cat, for example, or dog for that matter, that comes in with signs of acute renal insufficiency and you have access to a blood gas analyzer and you're suspecting ethylene glycol could be a cause, just check the anion gap. If it's very high and you've no other cause here to explain that, then it may be a marker that perhaps you need to think more carefully about whether ethylene glycol could be one of the causes, obviously looking at urine analysis, etc. So if you've got an increased anion gap, the bottom line is you've got a metabolic acidosis. So following that, and these will probably occur pretty much contemporaneously with your minimum database, but the minimum database is the information you want straight away. But it would be nice to then have an extended database comprising a full hematology and biochemistry, SNAP or specific pancreatic lipase to identify whether pancreatitis could be playing a part, very common in animals with diabetes. In cats with DKA, I would certainly recommend you do total T4 testing in FELV and FIV. And going back to what we mentioned before, complete urine analysis, which will include that culture, which I would prefer to be collected as soon as possible. You may also consider imaging, plus or minus the use of an ECG. The ECG is primarily to monitor potassium therapy, which we will need to use quite aggressively in most cases. So it's worth perhaps having the animal on constant ECG monitoring if you have the facilities to do so. Imaging may just be to exclude other diseases that might be contributing to the development of DKA, for example, pancreatitis or other inflammatory disorders within the abdominal cavity. So when you run a biochemistry panel, things to expect. It's very common for the animals to be azotemic. Generally, this will be pre-renal due to dehydration because they are often very, very dehydrated at the time of presentation. Obviously, they're hyperglycemic. They may have variability in their potassium levels. Some may be hyperkalemic to begin with. Some will be normal kalemic. Some will be hypokalemic. But what I can guarantee you is that after you start treatment, the potassium will drop precipitously. So even if they're hyperkalemic to begin with, don't panic too much. Your fluid therapy will resolve that. And almost certainly, you'll be having to supplement with potassium in the very near future. That's usually just associated with the acidosis. Hyponatremia is common, and that's due to urinary losses and osmotic diuresis. And we also will generally have increased liver enzymes and increased lipids, which are mainly just due to the diabetes mellitus itself. And as a result of dehydration, it's also fairly common to have an increase in your albumin levels. So, getting down to the nitty-gritty, how do we treat these patients? Well, there are four or five main categories, and the first is definitely the most important, and the first is to correct dehydration. Only after that do we then focus on acidosis and correcting that, and only after that do we then focus on the blood glucose. So it's not even second on our list, it's third. So restoring euglycemia is something that does not take immediate priority. We also need to correct any electrolyte abnormalities and, of course, search for and remove any underlying cause. Otherwise, our efforts to stabilise this patient will be in vain. So usually, going back to the top step, we're going to wait probably at least 2 to 4 hours after starting fluid therapy before we even consider giving insulin. So don't rush for the insulin bottle. You may actually make things worse. Okay. Correcting dehydration, fairly much common sense, but there are various choices of fluids that you could use, and the two potentially good choices would be either normal saline or Hartmann's or lactated ringers, whichever you prefer to call it. But there are some pros and cons of each of them. So take sodium chloride, for example, 0.9% sodium chloride. Most cases of diabetic ketoacidotics are hyponatremic, and normal saline contains the highest level of sodium of any of the fluids that we have. But normal saline is also slightly acidifying, and we have an animal that's acidemic, so in theory that could be a negative point. But because it has the most sodium present, it perhaps helps prevent a marked change in osmolality, so these are potential good points. Compare that to Hartmann's. Hartmann's contains potassium, and knowing that potassium levels will often drop precipitously after the start of treatment, that could be a benefit, although it's rarely enough, in fact it's almost never enough to stop you supplementing. You'll need to add more potassium to the fluid. Hartmann's also contains lactate, which is converted to bicarbonate, so that is potentially beneficial because it makes an alkalinizing fluid and we already have an acidosis, so that could be a good thing. But because the sodium levels are lower, we get a more rapid drop in osmolality. So there are pros and cons of both. And ultimately, it probably doesn't matter which one you use. If you only stock one type of fluid, for example, it doesn't matter which of these that you use. Both will be absolutely fine. I tend to start with sodium chloride, but I will use lactated ringers if it's one of the odd cases where sodium levels are actually increased prior to starting fluid therapy, but either solution is perfectly acceptable. Bad choices, any fluid containing glucose initially, and so if you stock what many of us who are interested in critical care medicine call the devil's fluid, which is 0.18% sodium chloride and 4% glucose, that is never a solution you should be reaching for in any sick patient. It's purely for maintenance, and I actually encourage people not to stock it in their practice, but any fluid containing glucose would be bad choices. We have a markedly hyperglycemic patient. Any especially low sodium fluid, so that also includes 0.18% sodium chloride and glucose. And just in case any of you are aware of this, there's also a solution available called Plasmalite. It's more commonly used in the United States. It's very much like Hartmann's, but rather than containing lactate, it contains acetate. But this is a bad choice because acetate may be a precursor to acetone, which is a ketone body. So I would seriously doubt that you've come across that fluid before, but just in case, or in case any of you are working in the US, it's worth knowing about that. Fluid requirements are considerable, and I think unless you stop to actually calculate them and work out exactly what you need, it's very, very likely you will underestimate the deficits that this patient actually has. So remember, in order to calculate the fluid deficit, we need to work out the percentage of dehydration, which is a clinical judgment. Most of these animals, if they come in collapsed, will have a dehydration percentage of around about 12%. You then multiply that by the body weight of the animal in kilograms and multiply that by 1,000. So that's the deficit you're looking at. You then need to add on daily maintenance requirements. So that's roughly in the region of 40 to 60 mils per kilo per day. And then adding the two together gives you the total amount that that animal needs over a 24 to 48 hour period. And you're wanting to replace those deficits over a 24 to 48 hour period. So take an example of a 30 kilogram dog, which is 12% dehydrated. So using the formula in the previous slide, we had 12 times 1,000 times the body weight is 3,600 mils. So the deficit alone in this dog is just under 4 litres of fluid. Then add on the maintenance requirements for this dog, that's another litre and a half. So in fact, that animal needs over 5 litres of fluid. So if you think that you can just hang a litre of Hartmann's or sodium chloride and let that run over the next 24 hours, it's very clear that there is no way that's going to benefit this patient to any great extent. This animal is very fluid deficient and it really takes very little time to calculate how much it needs and to work it out properly. So I really encourage you to think about doing that in these patients. And you want to replace maybe around 50% over the first 4 to 8 hours and then replace the rest over about 16 to 20 hours. But in fact, things are changing with regard to fluid therapy and the recommendations. Now it's often a case of giving boluses and then reassessing cardiovascular parameters after every bolus and determining how much more fluid to give. But this gives you a rough idea of what you need to give over the first 24-hour period. So that's our fluid therapy setup and underway and hopefully quite aggressive fluid therapy. We now need to think about the acidosis, but thankfully using fluid therapy itself is often enough to correct the acidosis. So by correcting the fluid balance, you will often correct the acidosis as well. So intravenous fluid therapy is the key to correcting acidosis. If you give the kidneys a chance, if you give them lots of fluid and increase the glomerular filtration rate, they will deal with any problems of acidosis. And once you start giving insulin, insulin itself metabolizes the ketones to bicarbonate, and we know bicarbonate is alkalinizing, so that in itself is going to help contribute towards correction of the acidosis. But lastly, we might think, well, why can't we just administer bicarbonate? And I would say strongly that that is not recommended unless the pH of the blood, the venous blood, is less than 7.1 despite fluid therapy and despite rehydration of the patient. The reason it's not advised is generally it's not needed. Generally, if your fluid therapy is aggressive enough and once you've started your insulin, it really won't be required. But if you administer bicarbonate, it can accelerate the development of hypokalemia and hypophosphatemia, which are likely to develop anyway and perhaps be difficult to control. So you're making life more difficult for yourself. In addition, if you give too much bicarbonate and you make the animal alkalemic, that's much more difficult to deal with. The kidneys are much more likely to struggle to deal with that than they are to deal with acidosis. So my recommendation is not to use bicarbonate unless you've got severe acidemia despite rehydration. So only now do we consider restoring euglycemia. Obviously, that's going to require the use of insulin therapy. And the first choice we need to consider is what type of insulin therapy we will use. So ultimately, we're thinking about either a regular or short-acting insulin versus the more standard Lenti insulin that we might use in dogs or PZI insulins that we might use more commonly in cats, for example. But the reason the regular insulin is highlighted here is really it's the only one you can use in diabetic ketoacidosis. We need constant monitoring of these animals and we need to make small adjustments to the protocol. If you give a Lenti insulin that could potentially last in the system for several hours, you'll have very little control over how fast or slow that glucose is coming down. Whereas with regular insulin, we can have very good control over what we're doing because the insulin itself isn't going to last very long. So it's absolutely essential to use a regular insulin in cases of diabetic ketoacidosis. We don't want rapid reductions in glucose. We don't want rapid drops in osmolality. So there are two or three protocols you can use. The most common are either the low-dose intermittent intramuscular regime or a constant rate infusion of insulin. There's also a subcutaneous protocol, which I'm going to explain to you, but it's not one that I favour. It's for cases where really finances are exceptionally tight or perhaps where there's a lack of 24-hour care or the owner's finances don't stretch to that. But really your choices are going to be between low-dose intermittent intramuscular protocol or a constant rate infusion. But the goal, regardless of which you choose, is to bring the blood glucose down slowly. We want the blood glucose to drop by between about 3 to 5 millimoles per litre per hour, no faster than that. And we want to maintain the blood glucose probably just above 14 millimoles per litre. So you're not aiming to normalise the glucose, you're just bringing it down to a more acceptable level. So you're not aiming for a blood glucose of 5, quite the opposite. We need to keep it perhaps around about 14 to 18 millimoles per litre in the first 24 hours so that we don't end up with rapid shifts in osmolality or cerebral edema. So just on the right here, we've got a couple of pictures. This is still available, can be harder to get hold of. Hypurine bovine, which is a regular insulin, otherwise known as neutral. So regular, neutral, soluble are all used interchangeably with regard to this type of insulin. But now also on the market, we have human insulins, which are short-acting, such as ActRapid. So I don't know which ones you might use in practice. But for me, I have most experience of either using hypurine bovine or ActRapid. Next step, of course, is to get a glucometer, and I'm sure that most of you in practice will have this. And there are more than one type of animal glucometer on the market, but the one I'm most familiar with is this one here. I'm not here to sell any monitors, but the reason that I've shown a picture of this one in particular is to remind you that really the human glucometers are not accurate enough for what we're doing. There is a different concentration of glucose in plasma between species. For example, in humans, 50% of glucose is in plasma. Compare that to dogs, where 87.5% is in plasma, and in cats, 93%. So the test strips for human glucometers will not give you an accurate reading. And I don't know if this is absolutely true or not, but it's always been my understanding that human glucometers perhaps are designed to read a little bit on the low side, so that the human who's using them will be prompted to take action before their blood glucose is low, so low that they can't take action themselves. So really, I would suggest get a veterinary glucometer. It will be worth its weight in gold. So let's go back to how we administer our insulin. So regular, soluble, neutral insulin, whatever you want to call it, they all mean the same thing. These types of insulin have immediate onset of action after intravenous administration. If you choose to give them intramuscularly, assuming the animal is relatively well hydrated, they will be absorbed and be active within about 10 to 30 minutes. And they can last anywhere between 2 to 8 hours. And I don't think you can predict that. It's very much patient dependent. So it will vary depending on the type of insulin and the patient you're administering it to. If you choose to use the intramuscular technique, insulin may be required for up to 2 to 3 days given by the IM route, so it can be very labour intensive. It's not impossible, but you need to be prepared to put the work in and to be constantly administering small doses of insulin. But as I've mentioned, some short-acting insulins can be difficult to obtain these days, but ones such as ActRapid or Humulin or Humalog are also available. But my experiences are with ActRapid and Hypurine Bovine. So my preference is to use an insulin CRI because it's less labour-intensive and I feel well, it's potentially more rewarding as well, but that's not a reason for doing it. More effective is probably the word I was looking for. There is a risk of causing hypoglycemia, and I've spent the last half hour or so reminding you that it's really important to avoid rapid shifts in glucose, so we need to be quite careful with its administration. But it's also really important to remember that insulin adheres to plastic. So if you're administering insulin into a giving set, into a bag of saline, for example, it is really important to discard the first 50 mils or so and to leave it sitting for an hour, because ultimately you need to make sure that any insulin that's there has bound to the plastic and what is left is actually going to be an insulin solution rather than just a solution without any insulin. But it does require constant monitoring for the constant rate infusion, and I would say a fluid pump is essential. So you really do need 24-hour facilities in order to do this protocol justice. So this is a little bit of a busy slide. I'm sorry for that, but hopefully it will make things a little bit clearer for you. So we would use regular insulin, neutral, soluble, whatever you want to call it. And we start off by giving the animal an intravenous bolus of 0.1 units per kilo. And do note that the dose of regular insulin is quite different to that of Lenti insulin. So don't get confused and give too much. So it's only 0.1 units per kilogram of neutral insulin. So that's a bolus. And then once you've done that, you can then set about making up your CRI. So we then want a separate intravenous bag of saline, which is dedicated solely to insulin treatment. So the animal will probably need two intravenous catheters, one for its regular intravenous fluid therapy and the other for insulin administration. You can piggyback them if necessary, but I think it's a better idea to have two catheters. For dogs, you would add 2.2 units of regular insulin per kilogram to 250 mils of 0.9% saline. For cats, it's less, 1 unit per kilo added to 250 mils of 0.9% saline. And then regardless of the weight of the animal, those solutions are then administered at a rate of only 5 to 10 mils per hour. Please note that's not per kilo per hour, just per hour. So it's a very low rate of infusion. Once you've started that, you would then check the glucose every 1 to 2 hours. And if you're not getting much response, you're not getting any reduction in glucose whatsoever or nothing worth talking about, you would then increase the rate of the insulin CRI by about 25%. But remember, we don't want to drop the glucose too quickly, so don't be in too much of a rush to try and normalize the blood glucose. Slow and steady wins the race. But remember, before you start with this, to flush 50 mils of the CRI solution through the catheter because of that binding to plastic, and preferably allow it to sit in the bag for about an hour before you start administering it so that that can take place and you know the solution is actually an insulin solution rather than just liquid with the insulin bound to the external plastic. I have used ACT Rapids as the insulin in a CRI without any complications. Hypurine bovine is another alternative. But there are also publications which have shown that insulins such as Aspart or Lispro, which are also human insulins, have similar efficacy. So you've got your insulin CRI underway. And once the blood glucose starts to get close to 14 millimoles per litre, we are then in a situation where if we continue, we might cause hypoglycemia, which we don't want to do, but we still need to switch off ketone production. So despite what you might expect, at this stage you continue with your insulin CRI, but you reduce the dose and you start administering glucose at the same time. So the insulin at the moment is not necessarily just to bring glucose down, it's also to switch off ketone production. And we need to continue to do that. So in order to avoid hypoglycemia, once the blood glucose reaches about 14 millimoles per litre, we need to then reduce the rate of the intravenous infusion. And using generally the other bag of fluids, the standard intravenous fluid therapy that you're giving via separate catheter, we then add glucose to the intravenous fluids in order to make up either a 2.5% to 5% glucose solution. And I think I have a slide reminding you how to do that. Yes, I do, because I always struggle with this myself. So in order to make a 5% dextrose solution, assuming you're using 50% dextrose, such as this here, there are other formulations available in other parts of the world, such as 30% in the Mediterranean. But in the UK, we generally have 50% dextrose. So in order to create a 5% solution, you would add 100 mils of 50% dextrose to 900 mils of saline. So you draw 100 mils of fluid out of the bag and then replace that with 100 mils of the 50% dextrose solution, and that gives you a 5% solution. For a 2.5% solution, you would add 50 mils of 50% dextrose to 950 mils of normal saline. Okay. So let's just touch on the low-dose intramuscular technique, which may be more suitable in some practices. We can't give insulin subcutaneously to begin with in these patients because they're too dehydrated. They won't absorb insulin from subcutaneous sites. So to begin with, our only options are intravenous or intramuscular. With the low-dose intramuscular regime, we start off with a loading dose of regular insulin of 0.2 units per kilo as a loading dose, and that's intramuscularly, obviously. And then we start to check the blood glucose every hour, immediately before we give a subsequent dose of insulin. And from that point, after the loading dose, we're going to administer 0.1 units per kilogram intramuscularly every hour until the blood glucose starts to drop to down below about 17 millimoles per litre. Once that's achieved, and we're heading towards this mark here, so somewhere between 14 and 17, we then need to continue with the insulin to switch off ketone production, but administer dextrose to prevent hypoglycemia. So at this stage, we then change the intravenous fluid therapy to either 2.5% or 5% dextrose solution. That's just a decision you need to make based on the blood glucose and the patient itself. And only at that stage, by which point the animal is probably going to be rehydrated, you can start giving subcutaneous regular insulin every 6 to 8 hours. So at this point, it becomes a little less labor intensive, but for this point, it's more labor intensive than the constant rate infusion. And at that stage, we're going to be monitoring the glucose every 2 to 4 hours. And we're adjusting the dose to keep the glucose. Obviously, the actual values are a little bit arbitrary, probably somewhere in the region of 9 to 12, 10 to 14 millimoles per liter. So not excessively low and not too close to the point where hypoglycemia may become evident. You can only change to a longer lasting insulin once the animal is eating. And unfortunately, if they've got comorbidities such as pancreatitis, that can take a week. So you need to be in it for the long haul here. And you need to be prepared that some animals may not turn the corner for several days. Several of them will be much better within 24, 48 hours, but it's good to set the owner's expectations accordingly. So if they've got comorbidities, especially such as pancreatitis, you may find it's several days before you're able to change this animal over to Lenzi insulin, which means a lot of intensive care and a lot of intensive monitoring. So just briefly touching on the intermittent subcutaneous regime, which I don't tend to use, but may be necessary if finances don't allow you to hospitalise the patient or the owner is against hospitalisation for whatever reason. And in this instance, you start off probably by giving a loading dose intramuscularly. It's still regular, neutral, soluble insulin, whichever you want to call it. You give a loading dose. If they're well hydrated, which I doubt they will be, you can give it subcut. But if they're dehydrated at the starting point, you give it intramuscularly. Thereafter, you measure glucose every 4 to 6 hours. So it's much less labor intensive than the other regimes, but less effective. And if you're not getting much reduction in the insulin levels, sorry, the glucose levels, you increase your dose of insulin by about 50%. Or you decrease it, obviously, if you're getting too fast a drop in glucose levels. But this runs the risk of getting things quite wrong. So it's not a protocol I would recommend unless this situation meant you had no alternative. And then once again, once blood glucose drops to a level where we're starting to get towards a more normal level, we need to then reduce the insulin by about 25% and then give them intravenous fluid therapy with glucose administered. So this is still going to require some form of hospitalisation for fluid therapy, and these animals should still be on fluid therapy while this is being received. So not ideal, but we don't live in an ideal world, and in some cases it may prove necessary. So only give longer acting forms of insulin such as can insulin or Lenti insulins or PZIs once the animal has stopped being sick and the acidosis has resolved. So that may take several days. Lastly, we then need to, or not quite lastly in fact, we need to correct electrolyte abnormalities. Many of them will have a total body deficit of potassium. In fact, almost all of them in my experience, even if they start off with hyperkalemia. Hypophosphatemia can also develop over the first 24 to 40 hours and can cause significant clinical effects such as a breakdown of red cells. Hypomagnesemia is another complication, one we might not necessarily be looking for because we don't measure magnesium terribly frequently, and also hyponatremia, which they may have had even before you started treatment. So let's just cover the most important of these, which is potassium balance. Remember that insulin moves potassium into cells with glucose. So as soon as you give insulin, it's going to move your glucose into the, sorry, move your potassium into the cells along with glucose, and that will result in a total depletion of potassium. So as soon as you start your insulin therapy, you can expect the potassium levels to drop quite significantly, and you need to be prepared for that. And the side effects of hypokalemia are various. So we can have lethargy, we can have muscle weakness, anorexia, ileus, severe hypokalemia in cats can cause a cervical ventriflexion. I'm sure many of you have seen that before, or even cardiac abnormalities. So these are not additional complications we need in an animal that's already presenting at death's door. So we must avoid hypokalemia if we can. So we need to supplement potassium, and I do advise the use of a fluid pump so that this is accurate. And we need to remember that there is a formula above which we must not exceed this level, otherwise it could be dangerous for the patient. It's known as Kmax, the maximum amount of potassium that can be given per hour. So you can calculate that and make sure you're below it. But whatever volume of potassium you're using, remember it must be diluted and mixed well before infusion. So as I mentioned, this can be calculated, but we're often in a rush, and there are easier ways, in my opinion, to try and work it out when you're dealing with an emergency patient. This is a little table extrapolated from the BSAVA formulary, so you will all have access to this. The only difference to my table is that in the formulary, it tells you the amount of potassium chloride added to 250 mL of fluid. Here I've got 1 litre of fluid, and the amounts you add are therefore different. Mine are four times what are shown in the formulary, just because my volume of fluid is four times what is shown in the formulary. So you measure your potassium, and let's say it's 3, and if the potassium was 3, we need to add 30 millimoles of potassium to each litre of fluids at maintenance rates. So that means if you only got a 500 ml bag for whatever reason, you would give 15. And let's say, for example, you had a 1 litre bag of fluids, but you were giving it at twice maintenance rates. To make sure you don't overdo the potassium, all you do is half the amount, so you would put 15 in the bag. I hope that's clear. I'll just go over it one more time. So this is at maintenance rates to 1 litre. So if you're giving it a twice maintenance, you divide by 2. If you're giving it in 50% less fluids, you divide by 2. Okay, so that's just a quick cheats method of working out the correct amount of potassium. Equally, if it was 3 times maintenance, you'd divide by 3, etc., etc., etc. Hypophosphatemia will occur after about 12 to 24 hours of insulin therapy, and it can cause a form of hemolytic anemia, muscle weakness, or even seizures. Many of them can be asymptomatic, but it is important you go looking for this. We need to avoid this if at all possible. If you do notice hypophosphatemia developing, there is supplementation in the form of potassium phosphate. One of the formulations I'm familiar with is Adiphos. Now, this is the recommendation for the dose, and it's given as a CRI, and we want to check the phosphate every 6 to 8 hours. So these animals are going to be sampled at least 3 times a day for electrolytes and phosphate levels to get this right. If you overdose with this, it can lead to hypocalcemia and metastatic calcification. So we need to be careful that we're not overdoing it. So you need to make efforts here to get the dose correct, even though it can be slightly tricky. Once again, I'm a big fan of cheats methods of doing things, quick methods of getting things right. And one of the easiest ways of supplementing potassium phosphate is to work out how much potassium you need to give the animal in millimoles per litre, and then supplement half of that as potassium chloride, which is the typical formulation you're using, and the other half is potassium phosphate. So that's a very easy method of working out how much phosphate you need to give. Give half the amount of potassium you need as potassium phosphate and half as potassium chloride. Okay, lastly, we now need to remove the underlying cause. This is absolutely critical because we have gone to all this effort in trying to save this animal from what is a very serious life-threatening disorder, only to potentially put it at risk of it happening again if we don't find the trigger that set it off in the first place. So there are a few factors you need to consider. The first one is owner factors. It may be that they're relatively new at administering insulin and their technique is poor, or they haven't been trained properly in how to administer insulin. So if their technique is poor and they're injecting into hair, or they're injecting an incorrect volume of insulin, then obviously that could be a huge problem. In addition, even with owners who have been injecting insulin for long time, if they're using the same point in the skin, the same point over and over again, fibrous tissue will develop there, and the absorption from fibrous sites will be much reduced. So make sure your owners are also aware that they need to move the point where they inject around a little bit with each injection to try and reduce the risk of fibrosis. Injecting into scar tissue is going to have very poor absorption. So go over in detail with the clients exactly what they do, how they store their insulin, how they administer it, when they administer it, check their insulin syringes, etc., etc. Check the insulins and date, check they're mixing it properly. The next category is animal factors, and that may be an underlying comorbidity. And as I've mentioned, the most common is either a bacterial urinary tract infection or pancreatitis. It's also possible that it could be hyperadrenocorticism, but I don't want you jumping to conclusions and testing every diabetic ketoacidotic for Cushing's. In fact, you cannot do that because an animal needs to be well in order to fully assess the test that you're using to diagnose Cushing's. So please do not do ACTH stimulation tests in sick diabetic ketoacidotics unless you're worried about Addison's. That's different. You cannot diagnose Cushing's in a sick patient. You need to wait until their other diseases are stabilized before you even consider that. And I would only consider the presence of hyperadrenocorticism if the patient had other clinical signs that were strongly supportive. It's not enough to have hepatomegaly and a pot belly. Those can be present in diabetes. So perhaps skin changes, perhaps PUPD despite what appears to be good control over your diabetes mellitus. And lastly, veterinary factors. It may be that you have failed to diagnose the diabetes early enough in the course of disease, or it may be that you've administered drugs which are antagonistic to insulin, and those will include things like prednisolone or we don't use them so much these days, progesterones. So if the animal's already receiving steroids, we need to try and find alternatives to prevent that insulin antagonism. Otherwise, we're likely to end up in the same situation further on down the line. Ancillary therapy. We do need to consider the use of antimicrobials. I like to have good reason for reaching for antibiotics, but I've mentioned that diabetics have poor neutrophil function and they often have ileus associated with their hypokalemia. That will predispose them to bacterial translocation, which increase their risk of sepsis. So I do tend to administer intravenous antibiotics for the first 24-48 hours of therapy and beyond if I feel there's justification for that. Obviously, we need to collect that urine sample for culture before those antibiotics are administered. Other therapies are just to control the other clinical signs that are present. Most of them will be vomiting or have nausea. So meropenem is a very powerful antiemetic. Metoclopramide, not much use in cats, but reasonable efficacy in dogs as far as a prokinetic is concerned as well. So if meropenem alone isn't sufficient to control the vomiting, you might need to add in metoclopramide on top of that if it's your dog. And you might also consider the use of antacids. I mentioned both ranitidine and famotidine here. Ranitidine is actually very good at being an antacid. It doesn't reduce the gastric pH by much, but it does have some prokinetic activity, which might be beneficial. Famotidine, on the other hand, is a slightly better antacid, but it doesn't have much in the way of prokinetic activity. So it depends what your rationale is for choosing. I know cimetidine is the licensed product in animals, but unfortunately, cimetidine is a really exceptionally poor antacid, and it also has lots of drug interactions, so I prefer not to use that. But you need to consider the cascade before you decide which drug you're going to choose. Monitoring of these patients while they're in the hospital, you might be monitoring glucose every hour to begin with and then down to every 2 to 4 hours, potassium every 6 to 8 hours, phosphate every 6 to 8 hours, and at least a daily check of urine or plasma ketones. But of course, you're also going to use clinical response as a marker of whether the dog is improving or not. When it's starting to appear brighter, showing interest in food, and it's no longer being sick, these are all signs that they're on the road to recovery. Just mentioning about urine and plasma ketones, don't be too despondent if initially the ketones are detected fairly weakly on the dipstick, but despite your therapy, ketones appear to be becoming more positive. That's because they're being oxidized from beta-hydroxybutyrate through the pathway. So the ketones may actually look as though they're getting worse before they actually improve. So please don't worry too much about that. That's something that's totally acceptable. So in summary, intravenous fluid therapy is much more important than insulin therapy initially. So intravenous fluid therapy is what you need to reach for right from the start. Achieve your glycemia slowly. Don't be in a rush to bring glucose back to normal. You'll do the patient more harm than good. Do consider measuring osmolality. That can give you an indication as to just how bad things are, so to speak. Do pay very close attention to potassium supplementation. Without it, it's unlikely the animal will get better, because the hypokalemia will cause ileus and make it less likely that the dog will start eating again, for example. But our aim is to get this animal to eat as soon as possible, because once they're eating and keeping food down, we can then change over to a more longer lasting preparation of insulin, which means it's a lot more less labor intensive, and we can get these animals home. But also remember, even once the glucose is relatively well controlled or below about 14 millimoles per litre, we must continue to give insulin, because we're using it to switch off ketone production, not just simply to reduce blood glucose. And remember too that the mortality rate, despite your best efforts, will still be in the region of about 25 to 30%. So owners should have their expectations set accordingly. But that equally means about 70% are survive to be discharged. And it's also worth discussing with the client in advance whether they're prepared to administer insulin, because this is a very time consuming and expensive process. And if the owner really feels strongly that they don't want to administer insulin to their animal at home, then clearly your efforts here in trying to save this patient from DKA are going to be thwarted once the patient is discharged. But the median hospitalization duration in studies that have been performed is on average about 6 days, but it can be longer if there are comorbidities such as pancreatitis, which make it which makes it more difficult for the animal to get back to a stable form of nutrition. So that's all I have for you today. I would like to pass you back now to Emer, and I'd like to thank you for your attention.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Yvonne for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.